Mind Webs. Short stories from the worlds of speculative fiction. This is Michael Hansen. This half hour, the story comes from New Worlds of Fantasy number 2, a collection put together by Terry Carr. This is Robert Sheckley's The Petrified World. Flanagan dreamed the dream again and managed to wake himself with a hoarse cry. He sat upright in bed and glared around him into the violet darkness. His teeth clenched and his lips were pulled back into a spastic grin. Beside him, he felt his wife Estelle stir and sit up. Flanagan didn't look at her. Still caught in his dream, he waited for tangible proofs of the world. A chair slowly drifted across his field of vision and fetched up against the wall with a quiet thump. Flanagan's face relaxed slightly, and then Estelle's hand was on his arm, a touch meant to be soothing, but which burned like lye.
"Here,"
she said.
"Here, drink this."
"No,"
Flanagan said.
"No, I'm all right now."
"Drink it anyhow."
"No, really, I really am all right."
For now, he was completely out of the grip of the nightmare. He was himself again, and the world was its habitual self. That was very precious to Flanagan. He didn't want to let go of it just now, not even for the soothing release of a sedative. Was it the same dream?
Yeah, just the same. I don't want to talk about it.
All right. She's humoring me, Flanagan thought. I frighten her. I frighten myself. And she asked, "Hon, what time is it?" Flanagan looked at his watch.
6:15.
But as he said it, the hour hand jumped convulsively forward.
No, it's 5 to 7.
"Can you get back to sleep?"
I don't think so. I think I'll stay up.
"Fine, dear." Estelle yawned, closed her eyes, opened them again and asked, "Hon, don't you think it might be a good idea if you called?"
"I have an appointment with him at 12:10.
"That's fine." And Estelle closed her eyes again. Sleep came over her while Flanagan watched. Her auburn hair turned a faint blue, and she sighed once heavily. Flanagan got out of bed and dressed. He was, for the most part, a large man, unusually easy to recognize. His features were curiously distinct. He had a rash on his neck. He was in no other way outstanding, except that he had a recurring dream which was driving him insane. He spent the next few hours on his front porch watching stars go nova in the dawn sky. Later, he went out for a stroll. As luck would have it, he ran into George Torstein just 2 blocks from his house. And several months ago, in an incautious moment, he had told Torstein about his dream. Torstein was a bluff, hearty fellow, a great believer in self-help, discipline, practicality, common sense, and other dull virtues. His hard-headed, no-nonsense attitude had come as a momentary relief to Flanagan. But now it acted as an abrasive. Men like Torstein were undoubtedly the salt of the earth and the backbone of the country, but for Flanagan, wrestling with the impalpable and losing, Torstein had grown from a nuisance into a horror. Torstein greeted him.
"Well, Tom, how's the boy?"
Fine. Just fine.
Flanagan nodded pleasantly and began to walk away under a melting green sky. But one did not escape from Torstein so easily.
"Well, Tom, boy, I've been thinking about your problem. I've been quite disturbed about you."
"Well, that's very nice of you, but really, you shouldn't concern yourself."
"Well, I do it because I want to. I take an interest in people, Tom. Always have, ever since I was a kid. And you and I have been friends and neighbors for a long time."
That's true enough,"
Flanagan said numbly. The worst thing about needing help was having to accept it.
Well, Tom, I think what would really help you would be a little vacation.
Thorstein had a simple prescription for everything. Since he practiced soul doctoring without a license, he was always careful to prescribe a drug you could buy over the counter.
I really can't afford a vacation this month.
The sky was ochre and pink now. Three pines had withered. An aged oak had turned into a youthful cactus. Thorstein laughed heartily.
Well, boy, you can't afford not to take a vacation just now. Did you ever consider that, Tom?
No, I guess not.
Well, consider it. You're tired, Tom. Tense, all keyed up. You've been working too hard.
I've been on leave of absence all week.
Flanagan glanced at his watch. The gold case had turned to lead. But the time seemed accurate enough. Nearly 2 hours had passed since he had begun this conversation.
Well, it isn't good enough. No, you've stayed right here in town, right close to your work. You need to get in touch with nature. Tom, when was the last time you went camping?
Camping? I don't think I've ever gone camping.
There, you see. Boy, you've got to put yourself back in touch with real things. Not streets and buildings, but, you know, mountains and rivers.
Flanagan looked at his watch again and was relieved to see it turn back to gold. He was glad. He had paid $60 for that case.
Trees and lakes, Tom. The feel of grass growing under your feet, the sight of tall black mountains marching across a golden sky.
Flanagan shook his head.
I've been in the country, George. It doesn't do anything for me.
Thorstein was obstinate.
You must get away from artificialities.
It all seems equally artificial. Trees or buildings, what's the difference?
Men make buildings, but God makes trees.
Flanagan had his doubts about both propositions, but he wasn't going to tell them to Thorstein.
You might have something there. I'll think about it.
You do that. Well, it happens I know the perfect place, Tom. It's in Maine, and it's right near this little lake.
Thorstein was a master of the interminable description. Luckily for Flanagan, there was a diversion. Across the street, a house burst into flames.
Hey, whose house is that?
Well, that's Makelby's. That's his third fire this month.
Maybe we ought to give the alarm.
Yeah, you're right. I'll do it myself. Now, remember what I told you about that place in Maine, Tom.
Thorstein turned to go, and something rather humorous happened. As he stepped over the pavement, the concrete liquefied under his left foot. Caught unawares, Thorstein went in, ankle deep. His forward motion pitched him headfirst into the street. Tom hurried to help him out before the concrete hardened again.
Are you all right?
I twisted my damn ankle. I think it's okay, though. I can walk.
Thorstein limped off to report the fire. Flanagan stayed and watched. He judged the fire had been caused by spontaneous combustion. In a few minutes, as he had expected, it put itself out by spontaneous decombustion. One shouldn't be pleased by another man's misfortunes, but Flanagan couldn't help chuckling about Thorstein's twisted ankle. Not even the sudden appearance of floodwaters on Main Street could mar his good spirits. He beamed at something like a steamboat with yellow stacks that went by in the sky. Then he remembered his dream, and the panic began again. He walked quickly to the doctor's office. Dr. Sampson's office was small and dark this week. The old gray sofa was gone. In its place were two Louis Kahn's chairs and a hammock. The worn carpet had finally rewoven itself, and there was a cigarette burn on the puce ceiling. But the portrait of Andretti was in its usual place on the wall, and the big free-form ashtray was scrupulously clean. The inner door opened, and Dr. Sampson's head popped out.
Hi,
he said.
It won't be a minute.
And his head popped back in again. Sampson was as good as his word. It took him exactly 3 seconds by Lanigan's watch to do whatever he had to do. 1 second later, Lanigan was stretched out on the leather couch with a fresh paper doily under his head. And Dr. Sampson was saying,
Well, Tom, how have things been going?
The same, Doc. Worse.
The dream?
Lanigan nodded.
Let's just run through it again.
I'd rather not.
Afraid?
More afraid than ever.
Even now?
Yes, especially now.
There was a moment of therapeutic silence, and then Dr. Sampson said,
You've spoken before of your fear of this dream, but you've never told me why you fear it so much.
Well, it sounds so silly.
Sampson's face was serious, quiet, composed, the face of a man who found nothing silly, who was constitutionally incapable of finding anything silly. It was a pose, perhaps, but one which Lanigan found reassuring.
All right, I'll tell you.
And then Lanigan stopped.
Go on.
Well, it's because I believe that somehow, in some way, I don't understand.
Yes, go on.
Well, that somehow the world of my dream is becoming the real world.
Lanigan stopped again and then went on with a rush.
And that someday I'm going to wake up and find myself in that world, and then that world will have become the real one, and this world will be the dream.
He turned to see how this mad revelation had affected Dr. Sampson. If the doctor was disturbed, he didn't show it. He was quietly lighting his pipe with the smoldering tip of his left forefinger. He blew out his forefinger and said,
Yes, please go on.
Go on, but that's it. That's the whole thing.
A spot the size of a quarter appeared on Sampson's mauve carpet. It darkened, thickened, grew into a small fruit tree. Sampson picked one of the purple pods, sniffed it, and then set it down on his desk, and he looked at Lanigan sternly, sadly.
You've told me about your dream world before, Tom.
Lanigan nodded.
And we've discussed it, traced its origins, analyzed its meaning for you. In past months, we've learned, I believe, why you need to cripple yourself with this nightmare fear.
And Lanigan nodded unhappily.
Yet you refuse the insights. You forget each time that your dream world is a dream. Nothing but a dream. Operated by arbitrary dream laws which you've invented to satisfy your psychic needs.
I wish I could believe that. I really do. The trouble is my dream world is so damnably reasonable.
Not at all, Tom. It's just that your delusion is hermetic, self-enclosed, self-sustaining. A man's actions are based upon certain assumptions about the nature of the world. Grant his assumptions, and his behavior is entirely reasonable. But to change those assumptions, those fundamental axioms, is nearly impossible. For example, how do you prove to a man that he's not being controlled by a secret radio that only he can hear?
Yeah, I see the problem. And that's me?
Yes, Tom. That, in effect, is you. You want me to prove to you that this world is real, and that the world of your dream is false. You propose to give up your fantasy if I supply you with the necessary proofs.
Yeah, that's it exactly.
But you see, I can't supply them. The nature of the world is apparent, but unprovable.
Lanigan thought for a while, then he said,
Look, Doc, I'm not as sick as a guy with a secret radio, am I?
No, you're not. You're more reasonable, more rational. You have doubts about the reality of the world, but luckily you also have doubts about the validity of, well, your delusion.
Then give it a try. I understand your problem, Doc, but I swear to you, I'll accept anything I can possibly bring myself to accept.
It's not my field, really. This sort of thing calls for a metaphysician. I don't think I'd be very skilled at it.
Give it a try.
Well, all right. Here goes.
Dr. Sampson's forehead wrinkled and shed as he concentrated, and then he said,
Well, it seems to me that we inspect the world through our senses, and therefore we must, in the final analysis, accept the testimony of those senses.
Flanagan nodded, and the doctor went on.
So, we know that a thing exists because our senses tell us it exists. How do we check the accuracy of our observations? Well, by comparing them with the sensory impressions of others. We know that our senses don't lie when other men's senses agree upon the existence of the thing in question.
Flanagan thought about this and then said,
Therefore, the real world is simply what most men think it is.
Sampson twisted his mouth and said,
I told you that metaphysics was not my forte. Yet I still think it is an acceptable demonstration.
Yes, but Doc, suppose all of those other observers are wrong. Now, for example, suppose there are many worlds and many realities, not just one. Suppose this is simply one arbitrary existence out of an infinity of existences. Or suppose that the nature of reality itself is capable of change and that somehow I'm able to perceive that change.
Sampson sighed, found a little green bat fluttering inside his jacket, and absent-mindedly crushed it with a ruler.
Well, there you are. I can't disprove a single one of your suppositions. I think, Tom, that we had better run through the entire dream.
Flanagan grimaced.
I really would rather not. I have a feeling...
I know you do. I know.
Sampson smiled faintly.
But this will prove or disprove it once and for all, won't it?
I guess so.
Flanagan took courage unwisely and said,
Well, the way it begins, the way my dream starts...
Even as he spoke, the horror came over him. He felt dizzy, sick, terrified. He tried to rise from the couch. The doctor's face ballooned over him. He saw a glint of metal, heard Sampson saying,
Just try to relax. Relax. Brief seizure. Now try to think of something pleasant.
And then either Flanagan or the world or both passed out. Flanagan and or the world came back to consciousness. Time may or may not have passed. Anything might or might not have happened. Flanagan sat up and looked at Sampson.
How do you feel now?
I'm all right. What happened?
You had a bad moment. Now take it easy for a bit.
Flanagan leaned back and tried to calm himself. The doctor was sitting at his desk writing notes. Flanagan counted to 20 with his eyes closed and then opened them cautiously. Sampson was still writing notes. Flanagan looked around the room, counted the 5 pictures on the wall, recounted them, looked at the green carpet, frowned at it, closed his eyes again. This time he counted to 50.
Well, care to talk about it now?
Asked Sampson, shutting the notebook.
No, not just now.
5 paintings, green carpet.
Well, just as you please. I think that our time is just about up, Tom, but if you'd care to lie down in the ante room...
No, thanks. I'll head for home.
He stood up, walked across the green carpet to the door, looked back at the 5 paintings and at the doctor, who smiled at him encouragingly. Then Flanagan went through the door and into the ante room, through the ante room to the outer door, and through that, down the corridor to the stairs and down the stairs to the street. He walked and looked at the trees, on which green leaves moved faintly and predictably in a faint breeze. There was traffic, which moved soberly down one side of the street and up the other. The sky was an unchanging blue, and had obviously been so for quite some time. Dream? He pinched himself. A dream pinch? He did not awaken. He shouted. An imaginary shout? He did not awaken. He was in the street of the world of his nightmare. The street at first seemed like any normal city street. There were paving stones, cars, people, buildings, a sky overhead, a sun in the sky, all perfectly normal. Except nothing was happening. The pavement never once yielded beneath his feet. Over there was the First National City Bank. It had been there yesterday, which was bad enough. But worse, it would be there without fail tomorrow, and the day after that, and the year after that. The First National City Bank, founded 1892, was grotesquely devoid of possibilities. It would never become a tomb, an airplane, the bones of a prehistoric monster. Sullenly, it would remain a building of concrete and steel, madly persisting in its fixity until men with tools came and tediously tore it down. Lanigan walked through this petrified world under a blue sky that oozed a sly white around the edges, teasingly promising something that was never delivered. Traffic moved implacably to the right. People crossed at crossings. Clocks were within minutes of agreement. Somewhere beyond the town lay countryside. But Lanigan knew that the grass did not grow under one's feet. It simply lay still. Growing, no doubt, but imperceptibly, unusable to the senses. And the mountains were still tall and black, but they were giant stopped in mid-stride. They would never march against a golden or purple or green sky. The essence of life, Dr. Sampson had once said, is change. The essence of death is immobility. Even a corpse has a vestige of life about it as long as its flesh rots, as long as maggots still feast on its blind eyes and blowflies suck the juice from the burst intestines. Lanigan looked around at the corpse of the world and perceived that it was dead. He screamed. He screamed while people gathered around and looked at him, but didn't do anything or become anything. And then a policeman came, as he was supposed to, but the sun didn't change shape once. And then an ambulance came down the invariant street, but without trumpets, minus trumpets, on four wheels instead of a pleasing 3 or 25. And the ambulance men brought him to a building which was exactly where they expected to find it. And there was a great deal of talk by people who stood untransformed, asking questions in a room with relentlessly white walls. And there was evening, and there was morning, and it was the first day. Volume New Worlds of Fantasy Number 2, an Ace book edited by Terry Carr. That was The Petrified World, a story by Robert Sheckley. This is Michael Hansen. Technical operation for this program by Bob Chan.